This is what you need to know about today. Kenya and Russia have a problem, really. And I'm gonna tell you what it is. President Trump needs help. He wants Europe to join his war with Iran, but they're saying we're kind of busy. I'll tell you what they're busy with. And Iran is not letting up with its targeted attacks and control of the Persian Gulf, which seems to be baffling the U.S. Secretary of War. Welcome to the Sanchez Effect. Let's get to it. Hello again, everybody. I'm Rick Sanchez. You know, Russia has a Kenya problem, and it began with reports that Kenyan men were being recruited to fight in Ukraine alongside Russian soldiers, and that a lot of them apparently were getting killed, and they had disappeared or died without their families even knowing about it, right? They didn't even know that they'd gone there. Of course, look, that's terrible. It's sad when anybody dies in a war, especially. And it's especially sad to see the reaction of these grieving mothers. Here, watch.
I'm still in disbelief. We have had a memorial service, but I don't believe it. I do not have his body or the badge they're saying they identified him with. They should at least give us one. What will I tell my child?
For me, I can blame the government. On all the deaths that have happened in Russia, I blame the government. Because I don't see how a Kenyan citizen would travel out of the country without the knowledge of the government.
I don't know whether my son survived. I don't know what happened to my son. I am just asking the government to help us.
Oh, my God. Your heart goes out to them. I mean, I feel sad just listening to their stories. That's terrible, right? And they're right. They're right to be complaining. So what is the real story here? And what, by the way, what's Russia's responsibility in all of this? And what are they going to now do about this? Because they need to do something. They need to deal with it. They need to address it, right? And you're going to find out because this story plays out. And you're gonna find out how it plays out. Kenya's foreign minister has flown to Russia to meet with his counterpart, Sergei Lavrov, to talk about this and tried to find a solution to this. And then we asked him to sit down with me, and he did. He sat down with me for a good interview that where I asked them very pertinent questions about this, and he takes us through it. And that's coming up here in just a little bit. Meanwhile, look at this headline. Because this is what Russians have been waking up to recently. The action here is that Ukraine has been firing drones, and that's not really news. This is kind of a common occurrence in Russia, a barrage of drones targeting Moscow. What's news in this case is 250. That's a big number. 250 drones in just 2 days. The good news for Russians and for people who live in Moscow in particular is that not a single drone was able to hit its target. Russian defense systems seem almost impenetrable. They intercept and destroy something like 99% of the incoming drones and the incoming missiles. The bad news is the internet in Russia is horrible right now. Horrible. It's hard to get a signal on your phone, and a lot of Russians are complaining, and part of it is because of this. Because of the security measures that they've deployed to make sure that this works. Now, by the way, 99% of the missiles are being stopped. That's a crazy good number compared to what the world's foremost ballistic missile expert from MIT, no less, recently told me right here on this show, Professor Ted Postol. He says that the THAAD system, you know, the anti-ballistic missile system, and the Patriot anti-ballistic missile systems that are being used right now in the Persian Gulf, which are U.S. systems, right? He said they're intercepting less. Remember, I said in Russia's case, they're intercepting 99% of incoming. He says in the case in the Gulf using the U.S. Defense systems, they're intercepting less than 5% of incoming.
I would say the intercept rate is well below 4 or 5%. In other words, it's not close It's not close to the numbers that they're telling us. Not close.
4 or 5% of the missiles that Iran is shooting are actually being intercepted. That's it?
Maybe. Yeah, maybe.
Wow.
Incidentally, this is what you see in Ukraine against the Russian Iskander missile, which has also been completely defeating Patriots.
By the way, those missiles being fired at Moscow, they're the handiwork of the UK, the French, and the Germans. I want to be clear about this. It's not really the Ukrainians who are doing this. I mean, it kind of is, but let's think this through, you and I. Ready? It's not Ukrainian intel. It's not Ukrainian guidance. They're not using Ukrainian satellites. This is Europe waging war on Russia, targeting Russian civilians. So think about that for a minute. Russia's not at war with the UK or France or Germany. Russia's not attacking the UK or France or Germany. But UK, France, Germany, and other countries in Europe are effectively at war with Russia. Nobody talks about this. Nobody says this out loud. But it's the truth. And while Europe continues its war with Russia, Mr. Trump is now asking the Europeans to join him on his war with Iran. Trump wants them to send ships to escort the tankers through the Strait of Hormuz, to which the Europeans are probably thinking, what are you, high? And have the Iranians do to us what they're already doing to you? No thanks, Mr. Trump. And they're not saying that officially, but they're kind of saying it. Meanwhile, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth, he seems shocked that the Iranians, who, by the way, you know this, right? Because you're smart. You watch our show. The Iranians are Persians. They're Persians. It's a 6,000-year-old civilization. So why is it weird that Persians would be protecting or attacking the ships of their attackers in the Persian Gulf? Persians? Persian Gulf? Duh. I mean, Mr. Trump says that if they would just stop doing what they're doing... Pardon me, Mr. Hegseth said this, not Mr. Trump. I got another one with Mr. Trump coming up. This is Mr. Hegseth, the war secretary. He says, if the Iranians would just stop doing this, then everything would be fine. Watch.
The only thing prohibiting transit in the Straits right now is Iran shooting at shipping. It is open for transit should Iran not do that. Now, there's a reason why we chose, as one of our primary objectives, destroy the Navy. We understood the ability to interdict shipping is something Iran has done for 40 years. And as the world is seeing, they are exercising sheer desperation in the Straits of Hormuz. Something we're dealing with, we have been dealing with it, and don't need to worry about it.
The ships would get through if somebody wasn't shooting at them. And I could dunk a basketball if I wasn't, 5'9". Yeah. It's like, we wouldn't have a problem if the Persians would just stop defending the Persian Gulf. Did we not think about this before we started a war with them? You know, that they, the Iranians or Persians, by the way, saying that we would be fine if only they would stop sinking ships is like saying that a frog would not bump its ass on the ground every time it hops, only if it had wings. Well, duh. You know, there's almost something crazy about what we're hearing from our U.S. officials these days. Even the president, who just, God bless him, he just delivered this gem.
In the last 2 weeks, they weren't supposed to go after all these other countries in the Middle East. Those missiles were set to go after them. So they hit Qatar, Saudi Arabia, UAE, Bahrain, Kuwait. Nobody expected that. We were shocked.
Who knew? Nobody expected that they would do something like that. Nobody except everybody. Everybody knew. Anybody who paid attention to what the Iranians were saying time and time again would know, including, you know who else knew? I knew. You know how I knew? Because I went to Iran, and I sat down, and I did an interview with the foreign minister of Iran, and I asked him, what are you going to do if the Americans actually attack and the negotiations falter? And here's what he said.
But what if they attack, and what if they use aggressive means? What would your retaliatory strategy then be?
We defend ourselves.
How?
You know how.
You would attack the U.S. bases in the Gulf countries?
We would attack U.S. and U.S. assets and facilities, everything they have in our, neighborhood.
You seem almost uncomfortable saying that. Are you?
I am. No, I'm not uncomfortable. The only point is I don't want to, express something.
Yes.
Which I don't like it to happen.
Of course.
I'm a man of diplomacy. I'm a man of dialogue.
I thought that was a fascinating moment because I almost feel like he didn't want to say it, but he was saying it. Meanwhile, even the U.S. television news networks, places where I used to work, interestingly enough, CNN and NBC, they usually don't cover the reality of war, or they simply lie about it. That's what they've done in the past. I know, I used to work there. They're admitting now that Iran is effectively doing exactly what Iran said that it would do. You know, just yesterday morning when I got up, I saw that Iran had hit the airport in Dubai, huge fire, right on the runway. They had to shut down the airport. Imagine if you're on a plane coming in from Gatwick or something, like so many people were, and all of a sudden the plane has to turn around and go back to London. This is happening a lot right now in Dubai. It's unfortunate, but it's the reality of this war. And the Iranians, as their way of defending themselves, continue to do this. They're hitting ships in the Gulf, only ships that they find are related to either the United States or Israel or others who they think are attacking them. That's what they say. And they're also hitting U.S. military installations on land. Watch this.
I'm going to show you a map of the approximate locations of these attacks on ships today in the Strait.
Iran's strategy is now clear, a war on global trade. So the more Iran suffers, the more everyone else will too.
Interestingly enough, those are reports from CNN and from NBC. Of course, both of those networks, you may know, if you understand American politics like I do, those are both networks that are blatantly anti-Trump. They hate Trump, right? So they're anti-Trump networks. And now they're using what may be a failing war, as they describe it, right, to attack him. It's not like they're wrong about criticizing the war. There's plenty to criticize about this war. But are they biased? Hell yes, they're biased. They're biased against the president. There's no question that if this were a liberal Democrat in the White House, let's suppose Biden was still the president, they would not be criticizing this war like that. They would not. They never criticized what Biden did in Gaza, for example. But they're criticizing Trump now. Just as, by the way, right now, Fox News, which is a Trump television network or a Republican television network, they're cheerleading this war. Yay, go Trump, you know. That's just the reality. It's ugly. It's terrible. That's not what journalism is supposed to be. But that's the reality of news in America right now, which is one of the reasons I'm no longer working there, nor want to. So what happens now? Well, the Trump administration is telling journalists in the United States that if they continue criticizing the war, hello, NBC, hello, CNN, they're going to have their licenses taken away, their broadcast licenses taken away. Yeah, in the United States, as you may know, broadcasters are regulated by the FCC. That's the Federal Communications Commission, right? That's who I basically was regulated by for so many years when I worked there. Its chairman is now a Trump loyalist, right? And he's officially warning news networks that they're going to be stripped of their right to broadcast the news if the Trump administration doesn't like the way they're covering the war. That's crazy, too. And by the way, while on the subject of wars and war coverage, I want you to check something out. This is a beauty from the land where journalism went to die, the UK. They're a talking head on something called the LBC Network or something like that. Says that even though Israel has killed 80 to 90,000 Palestinians and it keeps them enclosed in Gaza, surrounded by checkpoints with armed guards, it is Iran, not Israel, it is Iran that is an apartheid state Because according to this woman, she hears that women there are pressured to wear headscarves. Talk about a new reality. You got to watch this.
Isn't Iran something of an apartheid state, particularly when if you're a woman?
Have you ever been to Iran?
No, but there's lots of countries I haven't been to that I know about, hear about, read about, speak to.
It's not an apartheid state. No, it's not an apartheid.
Women are dragged off the street for not wearing the veil?
No, that's not true at all.
It is true.
Well, you can say it's true. But that doesn't make it a fact.
I think most people listening know that it is true.
Well, you know, I live in Iran. Many journalists come to Iran. If you tell me innocent people have died in Iran in prisons, I'd say probably yes.
Well, you know, it's interesting.
And I would say the same about your country as well. Mm. And I would say the same about your country. But in your country and in the West, the caricature of Iran is very far from reality. And the reason is because of your country's hatred for Iran, which has been ongoing for 45 years. If Iran was so deeply despised, then it should have collapsed by now, so long ago.
Just saying, but he's right. It's true. We in the West, I know, I used to be a part of it, shamefully. I admit it, I was wrong. We have these preconceived notions of these countries. What we think about China and Russia and Iran and the Middle East and Africa and Latin America, it's almost like, you know, we think we're better, you know? It's so wrong. And I got to tell you, I was one of those journalists that he's talking about. I was just in Iran. And I saw women wearing headscarves, hijabs, that covered all of their hair. I saw other women who only would wear it to cover part of their hair. I saw other women who wore it around their neck, and they might put it on if they felt they were in an environment where they needed to. I saw other women who wore nothing at all, right? I mean, nothing at all on their heads. They weren't naked. I saw some women, actually, the extremely religious ones who I met with, who covered almost everything in their bodies except for their eyes, which I thought, well, that's kind of, you know, odd. I saw young women wearing no headscarves and, in fact, very scantily clad clothing, almost like they're just wearing very Western attire, as Western as it gets. So it seemed like it was a choice thing, right? It seemed to be as much about their custom and their culture, as much about that than it was about policing, like she makes it sound, like people are being dragged off the streets. I didn't see that. I'm sure there's people from time to time who acted the fool or some mullah who was a jerk to some young woman or something. I'm sure that's happened. And by the way, if you travel and you get to understand different customs around the world, you realize that different countries have different ways of doing things. People are different. In Russia, you're forbidden from leaving your shoes on when you walk into somebody's house. That's crazy as an American to me. I don't want to see your feet, but in Russia, that's what they do. They walk into your house without their shoes. Here's another one. In China, you're expected to wear gloves when you eat a pizza or a hamburger. If that sounds weird to you, trust me, it's weird to me too. They give them to you when you sit down and I go, what the hell am I supposed to do with this? In Europe, you have to cover your hair when you go into a swimming pool. We don't cover our hair when we go in swimming pools in the United States. But you know what? It's their country, their rules, right? I mean, who the hell are we or this woman to make people abide by our rules? I mean, unless, of course, you're her, some British talking head who seems to want to suggest that a custom that she doesn't agree with, you know, might be a proper context for war. All right, now I'm going to want you to hear this conversation I promised you I would bring. It's a conversation with the foreign minister of Kenya. He came into town to meet with the foreign minister of Russia because of this problem, this conflict with Kenya. He met with Sergei Lavrov, and then he was kind enough to spend some time answering my questions about this conflict between Kenya and the Russian Federation. Before we do that, though, I want to thank you again. This is crazy what's going on with our show right now, with our program. Our audience recently has grown so large, and we are so humbled by this. tens and tens of millions of you are now tuning in to watch us every week. And it's really something, you know, and it's very nice, and I appreciate it from the bottom of my heart. So I got to give you some information because we're growing. We're now partnering with BitChute, a total free speech-based platform. You should check it out. We're also on Spotify. We're also on X. And, of course, we're on YouTube. So just look for my name in any of those platforms. Look for Rick Sanchez or look for Rick Sanchez TV. Any of those work. Here now, my interview with Kenya's Minister of Foreign Affairs, Dr. Musalia Mudavadi. Mr. Minister, thanks so much for joining us. It is so nice to see you. Thank you for taking time for us.
Thank you, Mr. Ricardo.
This is a very important day here. I understand you just had a meeting with Mr. Lavrov, and this is quite a brouhaha, the story that has developed with these soldiers who have died as a result of ending up in along the front. What assurances did you get from Mr. Lavrov to make sure that this thing is resolved? Because it looks like it seems to me like it's a misunderstanding in many ways between the people who came here, maybe the people who recruited them here, and their families. Am I wrong?
Well, first of all, let me put it this way. I'm happy that we're here, and we had this conversation with Minister Lavrov.
Yes, sir.
And this just goes to underscore the long partnership that we've had with Russia, a relationship of well over 60 years of partnership. So I came here because I did not want this episode to define our partnership with Russia, because it's broader, deeper, and it has had benefits for both countries over the years.
Was this Russia's fault? Did you feel like Russia did something?
So now, what was the issue? The issue here is that Kenyans were getting conscripted into the special operations in the Russian army for the special operations. This was not with the sanction of the Kenyan army, neither was it with the sanction of the Kenya government. These were Kenyans who, out of their own volition, either knowingly and in certain instances, maybe through misinformation, found themselves in the front line.
Yeah.
So the clear position is that this was not a government of Kenya sanctioned engagement, because under our penal code, it's an offense to enroll or enlist in a foreign army without the express authority of the President of the Republic. Here, in the context of him being the commander in chief of the defense forces.
Where it gets tricky, though, is if it's migratory. I'll give you an example. In the United States, Mexicans and South Americans come to the United States and they end up fighting in America's wars not soon after they arrive in the United States, because they end up recruited, but they're immigrants.
Yes, but you see, it depends on what is the law of that country. So I'm speaking in the context of the Kenyan law.
Right.
Okay, so the Kenyan law prohibits that kind of engagement, okay? Because it's not sanctioned legally from the Kenyan perspective for you to engage in that kind of assignment. So they got involved in the assignment. Then, unfortunately, some of them have either been injured, been maimed, or lost their lives. Now, this then filters back into Kenya.
I saw the interviews with the families. The families, mothers crying.
Absolutely.
I saw that. Yeah,
then
that's terrible.
They start saying what has happened to our children.
It's sad.
So that is where the issue was, and I'm glad we have had some understanding now.
Sounds like Mr. Lavrov said, look, if the best way to go is from now on, we're going to put a moratorium on Kenyans serving in our military, that's fine. And I think that's what he's done, right? He said from now
actually,
on.
Actually, it's not a moratorium. It's completely a no-no.
No. Okay. No Kenyans will join the Russian military.
No.
What if they want to?
Now that's the issue, because what they've been doing has been out of their own volition.
Yeah.
But what they didn't know that it is also in breach of Kenyan law.
Ah.
Okay. So we have to do a lot of educating here to let them understand that they're actually in breach of the Kenyan law. So what the government of Kenya is trying to propose to them is that there'll be an amnesty if you can pull out, so that you're not prosecuted.
You know what I'm thinking about?
In accordance with the Kenyan law. But that is what we hope will now be realized. And I'm happy that Minister Lavrov has said with further cooperation through the established channels,
mm-hmm.
They'll be able to, the people either in hospital can get consular services. And at the same time, where possible, we can talk about how they can be assisted to disengage, get recalled, and then assisted to get home.
Yeah, and it's a real credit to you, sir, if you don't mind my saying, mm-hmm. that you got on a plane, you came here, you had a conversation with Minister Lavrov. The two of you came to an agreement, one that seems to satisfy you and your government, as well as the government of Russia. And as I'm hearing you tell this story, I'm thinking, why can't the rest of the world do this? We're looking at a situation right now between Israel, Iran, and the United States, where, if anything, it has been the converse of what you just described. As an American, I still don't know what my country's concerns are, why they went to war, what this is really about, what has been accomplished, or when the hell we're going to get out of this thing. A lot of confusion there. I'm concerned as a citizen for world oil prices, for a potential food crisis, for what could happen in the Gulf. It's a really strange time. I'm wondering what your thoughts are with all of this for your country and for our planet.
Rick, for Kenya, we have about 400,000 Kenyans residing in various Gulf states, Gulf Cooperation states.
Mm-hmm.
They went there to work. So we have a fairly large diaspora constituency. In that whole belt.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things that we worry about is that if the situation escalates, how on earth are we going to move these people
out
and get them evacuated? So that's one issue. It is a logistical nightmare.
Mm-hmm. That's a primary issue, I imagine.
And it's a primary issue
Your
as
people.
Well.
Your people, yeah.
Now, beyond that, then we talk the economics of it. The level of disruption in terms of critical supply chains for Kenya and indeed for so many other countries globally is very severe. We get virtually all our fuel requirements from the Middle East. So that is being disrupted. Right now we are surviving on our reserves. As many other countries are doing.
Yeah, or Russia?
But
can you turn to Russia? I heard Mr. Putin talk about that today, that everybody, he's getting calls from everybody.
Well, you see that there'll be a lot of reorganization globally in terms of supply chains.
Yeah.
But what we are seeing, the disruption there in terms of critical supplies and also critical for our exports. Because that is again the same route that our exports go through. Agricultural produce, horticulture, and so forth. So
Fertilizer. 30% of the world's fertilizer.
Yeah, there you are. So 20% of the global volume, trade volume, is through there. Therefore, it's hitting African economies very hard.
Really?
Yes.
already?
Oh, yes. The knock-on effect is going to be very substantive. I mean, unless you had done forward purchases in fuel to lock in certain prices so that you can benefit from that. Clearly, the prices are now hitting beyond 100 USD to the barrel.
Yeah.
So that is going to be.
And there's a lag effect. I spoke with the Saudis.
So it's going to hit us very hard.
I'll share with you what I heard when I talked to the Qataris and I talked to the Saudis last week. They both told me the same thing. They said, whatever we're experiencing now will be worse because of the lag effect. Mm-hmm. We have all our oil out there already being delivered to all of our customers. Mm-hmm. But when those ships come back empty and try to refill, they're not going to be able to. Mm-hmm. That's going to double down the problem. Mm-hmm. And for, as we said, for LNG, for oil, as well as for fertilizer. Mm-hmm. And between 20 and 30% of all three of those things go through the Gulf. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is a real problem if it doesn't get solved.
Yeah, yeah. So
it's only going to escalate. You're right.
Yeah, so we hope it can come to an end quickly.
Do you hoping and thinking are different things?
I mean,
what is your...
I mean, we, from Kenya's perspective, let's be realistic.
Yeah.
We have to hope.
I know.
Yeah. Because we don't have the muscle to engage in any other way.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it is something that we really would want the international community to engage through the multilateral institutions and bring to an end.
Do you think, it seems to me, and people like me and my friend Tucker and Candace and a lot of us in the United States who are journalists who have been at this game for a long time are saying that the United States, our president, may have overplayed his hand here, that maybe they didn't see just what could come out of this, because it seems like what they thought was going to be a 2 or 3 day bombing mission and soon this would be over is looking like just the opposite. If anything, the expert, Mr. Minister, the experts that I've talked to have said that the Iranian missiles and their ability to cut through the U.S. missile defense systems is surprising everyone in the military establishment. They're saying only 5 of the missiles are being intercepted. The rest are getting through. It seems to be shocking everybody. It says the THAAD system is not working. The Patriot system is not working. These are supposed to be the best in the world. So that means Iran has almost a very successful position right now in this. That means it, and they're not going to stop, and they don't want to negotiate. So, do you see a quick solution to this?
I'm not a military expert, so
neither am I, by the way.
So
but I talked to them,
so I'll not be able to give you a competent response as to the capabilities of the equipment that is being used there. But one thing that we know is that human life is being lost.
Yeah.
Essential installations are being damaged in the region. And the level of disruption globally is going to have very serious consequences. So from Kenya's perspective, is we would like to see a de-escalation of the hostilities. Mm. People are being displaced, the sheer humanitarian consequences will also start playing out. Sooner or later, maybe also serious health problems could arise. From Kenya's perspective, we also fear another angle. There could be a mushrooming of potential terrorist cells.
Yeah.
And we have been hit a number of times from terrorist activities in Kenya. So this is what we would be focusing on. But critical to this is de-escalation.
If the world has always been a hegemony where the United States and Europe have run it and Israel has become a part of that, and this thing really goes south, Do you see the Global South community, the BRICS countries, or whatever we want to call them, the other guys, suddenly having a primordial position worldwide where we start to really see multipolarity? In other words, I guess the question I'm trying to ask you is, as I'm looking at this thing escalate and the thing becomes more difficult, I'm wondering if this will also escalate the position of those countries, which are led by countries like yours and countries like Russia and countries like China and countries like, you know, India and South Africa as well. Do you see a shift coming?
I think one of the things is that the P5, in my view, have an essential role to play. They have to marshal their strength, their moral strength, and they have to marshal, play down their ego.
And tell our viewers, our viewers what P5 is again.
The P5 and the Permanent Five.
Yeah.
There's the Security Council.
Got it.
The ones who have a permanent seat in the Security Council. Mm-hmm. I think the solution really rests in them putting their best foot forward and having a conversation to help bring an end to the very many hotspots. By the way, as we talk about the Middle East, Sudan is almost forgotten.
Yeah.
Just when we thought here's an opportunity for the international community to focus on Sudan, it seems that has not materialized. So this kind of conflicts that are all over, in my view, the P5, as I've called them, need to go that extra mile.
The permanent members of the UN Security Council.
And have a very candid conversation on how they can strengthen the multilateral framework and how they can work together to de-escalate the conflict that we are seeing.
I think they're going to have to look at my president and my government and maybe Israel as well, and maybe even Russia to a certain extent, and say, hey, you big guys, right? And maybe not just the P5, but other members of the United Nations, and say, you guys got to get back at paying attention to the rules. Mm-hmm. It, you know, what good is it to have a UN, Mr. Minister, if they've established rules, but nobody cares about those rules anymore or abides by them? Mm-hmm. Isn't that the real problem we have today?
But the strength of humanity will depend on us making sure that we play by the rules rather than completely discarding them. The worst would be to abandon the multilateral institutions.
Yeah,
that would be a more scary position.
Let's talk about Kenya. Mm-hmm. What a beautiful country you come from. What a country with so many beautiful resources. And it's just, I mean, when you think of the world.
Rick, why haven't you been there?
I'm coming. You and I are going to sit by the beach with one of those umbrella drinks, having a conversation like this.
Yes. Okay.
But Kenya's position has always been where it's been, somewhat, and this is a historical thing, as we know, somewhat beholden to the Brits and beholden to the West. And because of that, there have been debt issues that have, in some ways, eroded the power of the country. Where are you now in your country's ability to separate itself from that and develop its own way, so to speak?
I think one of the things is that since you've talked about debt, we have not defaulted. Kenya has not defaulted.
Good for you.
Yeah. And we've managed to have prudent economic programs. Mm-hmm. If I just give you some basic data.
You're talking about an IMF loan here and the relationship with the IMF.
Not just the IMF. I'm just talking about globally.
Got it.
IMF itself has kind of looked at us differently. We are rated as the sixth largest economy in the continent as we speak. institutions like Standard & Poor's, Moody's, have upgraded our ratings. So in terms of standing, we are managing quite well. Our forex reserves are at about 4.6 trillion, which is the, I mean, trillion Kenya shillings, mm-hmm. which is about, 14.2 trillion Kenya shillings, which is equivalent to $14 billion or something. Mm. And we have a 6 months cover, import cover, with our foreign reserves.
It's impressive.
Okay. So we are sitting fairly well in that context.
Sounds responsible.
All right.
Yeah.
So from Kenya's perspective, we have a program, we have an economic agenda, and we are pursuing it effectively. So I don't see, apart from the kind of shocks that we are talking about, which are going to be disruptive, not just to Kenya, but to all other countries, as things stand now, I would say that Kenya is sitting fairly well economically.
You know, it's funny to see how in the old days, the West would go into places like where I'm from, Latin America. Mm-hmm. In our case, it was mostly the United States based on the Monroe Doctrine. Mm-hmm. In your case, it was more the Brits and the French and all these other European countries who would go in and colonize. Mm-hmm. And now we're seeing the influences of the Belt and Road Initiative with China. We're seeing the Russians have a stake in countries like yours. What is the feel in your country? Is it a welcome? Are you putting out the welcome mat for China and Russia and these other global South countries that in the past didn't engage in your country?
We want investors.
Yeah.
We want investors. It's part of the things that we talked about. Apart from the issues that we have covered here, we also looked at our other engagement with Russia in terms of the economy, in terms of investment, in terms of growing tourism, in terms of ICT partnership. Mm-hmm. And the same holds with China. I was talking to the minister, and I was emphasizing...
Minister Lavrov.
Yes. Emphasizing the Africa Continental Free Trade Area. We want to grow trade internally, more integrated connectivity and partnership amongst the African countries and the African countries and other parts of the world. In terms of the growth that we are seeing in trade today, mm-hmm. The Asian bloc of countries is contributing more to the growth of trade in Africa, away from the traditional markets. The growth is faster with Asian countries, being driven largely by China and India.
Hmm.
Okay, they're contributing quite substantially to that rise in trade volumes. So for a country like ours, diversification is absolutely important. And we want a continent that is better connected, more integrated, and that is also enhancing trade amongst the member states. This is one area where we have been weak as a continent. So this is the target that we have. And President Ruto is the champion for the initiative around the Africa Continental Free Trade Area. His primary objective on behalf of the African Union countries is to really drive this process.
Good for you.
Yeah.
It's impressive. Everything I've read about Kenya from an economic standpoint sounds like they're making very responsible decisions. Let's talk about security now. Mm-hmm. Hopefully last on the agenda. Kenya hasn't had the same problems that some of your neighbors have had, but there's still always the possibility of a spillover. How certain do you feel about the security of the region with so many of the stories we read about movements that are formed and wars and battles that break out and guerrilla movements, et cetera? Where is Kenya in all of this?
Actually, it worries us because our security outlay will be as good as the region that you are in. And therefore, we are at the forefront, always as an anchor state, to help countries in the region to foster peace. And therefore, we engage substantially through the African Union, through the peace and security entity within the African Union. We have institutions like IGAD, and then through the regional economic blocks like the East African Community and the Great Lakes entity, we try to promote peaceful solutions and resolution to any potential conflicts. So we have every reason to invest in that process. We also want to encourage the countries in the region to adopt strong democratic practices because it helps in ensuring that you can have long-lasting peace over a period of time. So this is our primary goal, that work within the framework of the African Union, work within the context of the economic blocks, so that there's respect for these institutions. And through those institutions, we can have a better grip on peace and security issues in the region.
Do you feel like there's a certain level of neutrality in Kenya where it's okay to be friends with China and Russia and the United States and the Europeans and other nations at the same time? We don't have to pick one at the expense or at the of the others.
Strategic neutrality is important.
You believe in that?
Oh, yes. Yeah. We have to be strategically neutral on these issues. That's how we have established our anchor state in terms of peace and security in the region. We have opened our doors to have a conversation with different parties so that we appear as, not just appear, but actually we play out as fair arbiters in most of the issues. If you look at South Sudan, virtually the whole process and negotiation that led to South Sudan's independence as a state was literally crafted in Nairobi. If you go back historically, our founding father, Mzee Jomo Kenyatta, was deep into the conversation in Angola. We have always worked very closely with Somalia, especially after they had the internal turmoil. And we're happy that they're now on the road to a lot of calm. So we continue to engage constructively with our neighbors.
What is it, maybe finally, I should probably ask you this, only because it's something that's happening right now in the world. It's almost a feeling like we're going into this era where might makes right. And maybe sometimes might should make right, but what we just saw in Venezuela, what we might soon see in the place where I was born, Cuba, what we're witnessing in Iran, where a strong country comes in and says, I am going to make you, through will, do what I want, it's worrying. You mentioned earlier that, to a certain extent, what we have to do is strengthen the United Nations so we have countries that can stand up and maybe we can learn from each other, or maybe we can tell another country. You can't do that. But right now, I don't know. I don't remember ever living in a world, and I'm not a young guy, where I've seen it quite this bad. Does it worry you, too?
It does. It does worry me. The UN is about to have an election for a new Secretary General. I think this is an opportunity perhaps for the international community, the global community, to think carefully on the future of the UN. And I hope it can then inform the choice of leadership that will be decided upon very soon. But it does worry us. Some of these things are very difficult to understand. It's a phenomena that is completely strange.
Final question.
Yeah.
I come from the West, and I apologize for saying this about us, but it is the truth. Most of us could not find Kenya on a map. Most of us could not find Ukraine on a map. Many of us don't know much about the world other than the countries that we live in, and in some cases, maybe even just the communities that we live in. So it's always good when I talk to someone like you who comes from one of the most beautiful, one of the most glorious countries in the world that has a little bit of everything as you look at it, from the mountains to the pastures to the gorgeous beaches. What do people watching us around the world, some 20, 30 million people who are going to watch this interview, what do they need to know about your country that they probably don't know?
Well, Kenya is a very hospitable country. We are the only country in the global south that has the United Nations headquarters. We have the UNEP and UN Habitat, the UNON, in Nairobi. Maybe that's something they should look at. But more important, the people of Kenya are people who have had a democratic process every 5 years since we got independence. You know, we have come to where we are because of espousing strong democratic principles. Mm. And the message we are sending is that if we can do it every 5 years, Africa is, by every sense of the word, changing. Mm. A continent with 1.5 billion people, young population, median age is 20.
Yes. Yes.
When you
the look, future is there.
When you look at global economic indicators, most of the other areas are either having a decline or their demographic configuration is speaking volumes to them. Mm. Africa is the new frontier, and Kenya is an important entry point.
Yeah. Sounds like a place worth consideration for investment, or if nothing else, a nice vacation.
Come for the vacation and bring some investors with you.
Mr. Minister, you are so wise, so kind, and so smart. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I really appreciate your time. Thank you for sitting with us and answering all of these questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good.